Dave from New Jersey, it's the SNL Nerds, a show where two comics from New Jersey nerd out about Saturday Night Live. I'm your co-host, Darren Patterson.
And I'm your co-host, John Trumbull.
Hey, John, how's it going this lovely summer afternoon?
You all right? I'm doing all right. How are you doing?
Well, John, I'm gonna raise a fuss. I'm gonna raise a holler. I forgot to write, damn it. I'm about to work in all summer just to try to earn a dollar. Every time I call my baby trying to get a date, my boss says, "No dice, son. You got to work late." Sometimes I wonder what I'm going to do. But there ain't no cure for the Summertime Blues Brothers 2000. And that's the movie we're talking about today.
Wow.
You like that? Happy I did that.
Ooh. I would have been so much more impressed if you hadn't had to read half those lyrics off your phone. But
dude, I'm a busy man. I don't have time to remember Eddie Cochran lyrics off the rip.
It took me so long to recognize that song because I just realized I don't really know the lyrics of that song beyond "There Ain't No Cure for the Summertime Blues."
it's weird how songs are like that where you just know the chorus and then the rest of the song is just like. Just white noise.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah,
exactly.
So that's about, he had the Summertime Blues because the boss man's on his back.
Yeah, well, that'll do it.
Yeah, and I have the blues a bit from watching this movie.
you did not care for this movie.
I did not care for this. We'll get into it.
Yeah.
For those that don't know, I mean, you got to know. It's on the little description thing on the... on your phone or device.
Our listeners are illiterate, Darren.
Well, this is why I'm talking them through it then.
Okay.
We're talking about Blues Brothers 2000. The movie came out on February 6, 1998.
That's right. A movie called Blues Brothers 2000 came out in 1998.
So close. Yeah.
And it's not like they made it in 1998 and it takes place in 2000, because it opens up and it says 18 years later.
Yeah.
It takes place in 1998.
Yeah, so I don't know why they went with... I guess Blues Brothers 2000 just sounds cooler than Blues Brothers 1998.
Yeah, definitely.
So they're just like, all right, 2000.
But, I mean, was anyone really thinking much about the year 2000 in 1998? I don't think I was.
In the year 2000!
Yeah, outside of, bits on Late Night with Conan O'Brien.
Okay, fine. Yeah. Well, there was that. But, yeah, so, film directed by John Landis, guy that directed the first Blues Brothers, written by Aykroyd and Landis, who also wrote and... You wrote the first Blues Brothers movie. The budget for this was like about $30 million, gross about $14 million. So, not a big hit.
No. Yeah, I'm seeing the budget here on Wikipedia. It says it was $28 million.
Oh my God! Are my notes?
Did you lie to me?
Did my notes fail me? I saw it 30.
Okay.
28 and 30.
Wow.
But either way, it grossed 14. So either way, it was a
yeah. Either way, it did not do well. It did not make its budget back.
The stinkeroo.
Because you have a big hit movie in 1980, so of course you make a sequel 18 years later.
Of course.
When one of the principals has died.
You strike while the iron's cooled.
Yes.
Exactly.
I mean, and John Belushi, you know, when he passed, he was arguably the bigger star of the two.
I would say so, absolutely.
I mean, not that Dan Aykroyd hasn't done great stuff on his own.
Yeah, no, nothing but trouble. No, I'm sorry. I can't even say that with a straight face. I'm sorry.
No.
I couldn't do it. Dragnet? No, I can't do it.
I kind of like Dragnet. I like moments of Dragnet.
I shouldn't poo-poo Dragnet. There were a couple times I'd watch on Channel 11 on a Sunday afternoon and be like, oh, this is funny.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the Virgin Connie Swale, come on.
Yes, Muzz Amel. Amel Muzz.
You know, you got Christopher Plummer, you got Dabney Coleman.
You got Hanks?
You got Tom Hanks, young Tom Hanks.
A young, spry Hanks.
Yes.
How about this? Yes. All right.
He says, thank God it's Friday.
Yeah.
It's funny because his name is Friday.
Get it? Oh, that's... Oh!
Yeah, I know. You just got that.
Whoa. Wow. That was cerebral humor right there. I didn't get it till just now.
But anyway, enough about the late 80s adaptation of Dragnet.
Let's talk about the late 90s adaptation of Blues Brothers 2000.
Yeah.
I don't know. What are your thoughts on this? Because you say you never saw this before.
I had never seen it before. Had you seen it before?
No. I mean, this came out when I was in college. Was it February 98? So I'm pretty sure we got a screening for it, but I didn't go. I think I handed it off to
In protest?
Guys. Yeah. No. Yes.
Were you outside picketing?
Not my Posting. Blues Brothers.
No Belushi, no peace.
No, I think I just didn't see any interest in it. I think this might have been before I saw the first Blues Brothers, so I didn't.
Oh.
Because I don't think I saw the first Blue Brother until like after college for some reason.
Wow.
But yeah, I guess I just didn't go. I was like, I don't know. And I think one of the other writers went because they didn't have anything to do, and they were like, it was whatever.
So I mean, you're making this sequel, and it's like, how are you going to fill the void of not having John Belushi there?
Yeah.
You don't have John Belushi. You don't have his character of Jake Blues.
Right.
Juliet Jake.
Right.
So what do you do? What do you, Darren Patterson, do?
Yeah. I don't do this movie. Yes. I do something else.
Yes, that is the correct answer. How do we realize this and John Landis and Dan Aykroyd did not realize this?
I don't know. I guess I felt, I don't know. Did they say like what pushed them to or compel them to do this movie? They just wanted to do another. Is this a cash grab? Are they cash grabbing?
Maybe. I mean, it's there. I watched, there was behind the scenes featurette on the DVD. That I got from my local library.
Mm-hmm.
And Aykroyd said something like he felt like he was ready to do it. Like enough time had passed. So maybe he was like more at peace with Belushi not being there. And by this time, like he had the House of Blues restaurants.
Oh.
And they were doing, like he and Jim Belushi were doing, appearances as the Blues Brothers.
Right.
Jim Belushi was not playing John Belushi's character. He was playing a new character named Brother Z, I believe.
Z.
When it came time to do this movie, Jim Belushi had a scheduling conflict.
What was he doing? Like the
he was doing
the principal.
He had been cast in the ABC drama Total Security.
Oh, of course, who could forget that?
So this is apparently even pre, according to Jim.
Wow.
But it is not a good sign when Jim Belushi is too busy to do your movie.
Yeah, I mean, he's like, oh.
That's...
I mean, if he was in it, it might have been better, I think.
Really? Jim Belushi's the deal breaker for you?
I don't know. Look, I'm just grasping at straws here. It might have been a little, just because, all right, because, like you just mentioned, like, without John Belushi in this movie, there is a huge void. You do feel it. Because in the original one, like, you know, John Belushi, he was like the fast-talking, you know, slick-talking con man. He was like the mouthpiece. And Aykroyd kind of played the background. Like
Elwood was the quiet one.
Yeah.
He was not very verbose. Aykroyd, as an actor, he's very verbose. And he has a few bits in this movie where he goes off on...
Like his speed talk thing he does.
Yeah. And it kind of worked, but it was weird. It was a real weird shift for Elwood, because Elwood's now the lead guy, and he wasn't really the lead guy before.
Yeah, it's like when a band, like their lead singer passes away or leaves the band. Now somebody else has, it's like, somebody else has to be the lead singer. It's
like, do you want to see Queen with Adam Lambert?
The Journey with that other guy?
Oh, yeah, the new Steve Perry-esque guy.
Yeah.
Or NXS with... that guy that they found on the reality show.
We don't even know his name. That's how much we want to see it. But I mean, sometimes it does work, like when, you know, Peter Gabriel left Genesis and then they had Phil Collins up there.
Or AC/DC, they successfully replaced, was it Bon Scott that passed away?
Yes, Bon Scott.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean it can work, but
very rarely.
Yeah, I mean, just because Belushi was such a presence and without him, it's, I mean, what is it?
And it's not just about the musical presence, it's his comedic presence and the chemistry that he and Aykroyd had together. I mean, that's very tough to replace or replicate.
Yeah, very much so. I mean, I was trying to figure out like why this movie didn't work as much as the first movie, and I think I mean the fact that
there's so many reasons.
Well, I think the fact that Belushi's in it is a huge part, and also I think even though the first movie was like a love letter to the blues and R&B, it also had a very strong kind of punk rock vibe to it. Like
I can see that.
Like fast-paced, frenetic, like anarchistic, you know, anti-establishment thing to it. Like they're just running from the cops. Like
this movie meanders a lot more.
It does.
Before we get way too deep into I'm going to read the summary on the back of the DVD, because I feel like probably not many people in the audience have seen this.
I would wager.
So I want to give people a general idea of what this is about. So here's the summary on the back of the DVD. 18 years after the brothers' original mission from God, Elwood Blues, Dan Aykroyd, is getting out of prison and discovering that much has changed in the time he's been away. His partner, Jake, is gone. His band is no longer together, and the orphanage where they grew up has been demolished. So,
let's talk about...
Right there. The whole point of the first movie was saving the orphanage where they grew up.
And they didn't save the orphanage.
And it's been demolished in between.
So what the fuck is the point?
You've retroactively made the entire first movie pointless. Utterly, utterly pointless.
Why did they do that? I don't understand.
And that's not something they had to do.
No, it's not.
It's just something they did.
I mean, is it because the money that they gave was from two criminals and so the cops were
I was thinking about that, but they didn't. I mean, they did illegal things in the pursuit of that money, but they got the money fair and square.
They did.
So,
but I don't know. Maybe the cops were like, well, yeah, this money was made fair and square, but you did demolish half of Illinois.
It's not like they explain this either. It's just. Okay.
Let's
go back to the summary.
Let's go to the summary.
We're already getting heated on this. Elwood still soon realizes that he must embark on a whole new mission to reassemble the old band. This time, with the help of a soulful bartender, John Goodman, compete at Queen Musette's Erykah Badu's Battle of the Bands and set a wayward orphan named Buster on the path to redemption. In the midst of the mayhem, he's got to prove to the police that there's magic in the music and a mysterious method behind the Blues Brothers' madness. Special appearances by B.B. King, Aretha Franklin, James Brown, Johnny Lang, Blues Traveler, Eric Clapton, and many more. It's an action-packed comedy with lots of rhythm and blues.
I mean, that last part's right. But the other part, I don't know.
Yeah. So to replace John Belushi, we have not only John Goodman as Mighty Mac.
Mighty Mac.
Who's a bartender that Aykroyd meets.
Yeah, they don't get too much into his character, really.
No, they don't.
I mean, there's Joe Morton, too.
We have Joe Morton, who
you
probably know from the Terminator movies.
Of course.
As Miles Dyson.
Yeah, and he was in that Justice League movie.
He was Cyborg's dad. Yeah,
Cyborg's dad, and he was in that Kerry Washington movie, I can't remember. Scandal, there you go.
Oh, okay.
So there you go.
I didn't know he was in Scandal. All right, you go, Joe Morton. Yeah. And then he has...
They got some kid. Buster.
Buster, who's like this 10-year-old orphan.
Right.
Okay, so Elwood gets out of jail.
Oh, yeah, let's go. So let's describe what happens.
He gets out of prison at the beginning of the movie. It's very parallel to the beginning of the first movie where Jake is getting out of jail and Elwood's there to greet him.
Right, right.
And here, Elwood gets out of jail and Jake is not there to greet him.
Yeah.
Because John Belushi has been dead since 1982.
Yes, of course. Yeah, wow. Yeah, but the thing is, they don't even, throughout this movie, they don't say that he's... They don't say how he died, or they don't even say that he's dead in it. If you notice,
no.
So when Elwood comes out, he's just waiting by the side of the road, waiting for Jake,
and he's waiting there for over a day.
He literally waits there all night, and then the next morning, the warden, played by Frank Oz again,
right.
He looks outside. It's like, hey, why is that Elwood? Why is he out there? And I think one of the other guards, played by Tom Davis, says, mm-hmm. Oh yeah, he was released yesterday. And then Frank Oz says, hey, did anybody tell him about Jake? And they're like, oh no, I thought you did.
Yeah. Okay, and that's weird because, one, it implies that Jake somehow got out of prison before Elwood.
Right.
Which I would think that they would be charged for all the same stuff.
You think they would.
Because they were thrown in prison for all that. And if anything, you would think Jake would be getting a harsher sentence because he was probably on parole or something.
Yeah, that's true.
Or it was at least a second offense.
Yeah, I mean, they were in the same prison in the original movie. So they wouldn't have seen each other?
Yeah.
Wouldn't he have heard from somebody? Like, hey, by the way, your brother's gone?
Right. He's apparently not in touch with anybody on the outside. I mean, I realize you have to address why Belushi is not there. But
right.
I don't understand the logic of how Jake gets out of prison before Elwood.
I don't either. And like I said, they don't say how he died, but they showed Frank Oz walks out to Elwood, and he's kind of whispering to him.
There's a long shot, so you don't hear what Frank Oz says to Elwood.
Yeah, there's no audio.
No.
You just hear him say something about, Jake, and then Elwood's head kind of slumps down.
Yeah, and I thought that was a fine way to do it.
Right.
I mean, because you have to address the elephant in the room.
You
Or in this case, the elephant not in the room.
Wow, too soon. And throughout the movie, people say, oh, I'm sorry to hear about Jake.
I thought it was done tastefully.
Yeah, yeah.
And they address it quickly, and that's good.
Yeah.
And...
And so anyway, so
but it's just weird.
Yeah. So then Elwood's like, "All right, my brother is gone now. What do I do?" And then a woman picks him up in a car and says, "Oh, who was it? Willie sent me
your drummer.
Your drummer who now owns a strip club." So he drives
a stripster.
Stripster club. What?
That's what they call it in the movie. It's a stripster club.
Why is it called?
I'm assuming that is a term for like a PG-13 strip club where no one actually gets naked.
Oh, I thought it was like a strip club for hipsters or something.
Maybe. It could be that. I don't know. But this is because it is a PG-13 movie. That is another mistake, by the way.
Oh, boy.
Because the first Blues Brothers was rated R.
Was it R?
It was R.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I don't think it was.
Right. But, you know, and it's not like the first Blues Brothers had gratuitous nudity or anything, or that I was like clamoring to see gratuitous nudity, but it's like very obvious that this is a PG-13 movie.
Yeah, it's obvious that trying to cater toward the younger crowd.
Right.
But like the Blues Brothers isn't for younger people, so I don't know why they're doing this.
Yeah, it's for like teens and up. I mean, it's like, I don't get it.
Yeah. Oh, and just a quick shout out. Like in the beginning of this movie, they did have a little thing that said, you know, this movie is dedicated to John Belushi, Cab Calloway, John Candy.
Right.
Which I thought was so nice.
Right, which is a wonderful way to start out your comedy. Well, let's remind you of these three people who are dead.
Yeah.
That really puts you right in the, are you ready to laugh? God.
It's like when you do a comedy show at like a benefit. And it's like, all right, this is the person who has cancer. And
right. We're raising money for these cats who have cancer.
Let's bow our heads and...
Yeah.
And now it's time for your comedian, ladies and gentlemen, Darren Patterson.
Yeah. Yeah, and we've both done and been to shows like that. And it can be tough.
It's a tightrope to walk.
So
Elwood goes back into, you know, catches a ride, and his first thing is to do is go see the Penguin.
He sees the Penguin, who's the same nun for the first movie.
Right.
And she's like, "You're going to take, you're going to mentor this orphan Buster."
Yes,
which is also weird because it's like, why would you select Elwood Blues to mentor an orphan?
It's like, you know what he did, right?
You know he's been in prison for 18 years, right?
You know what he's done. You've read the rap sheet,
and it's not like you had a high opinion of him before that.
Yeah,
I don't. That's weird. And also, it's like the Mother Superior, the Penguin. She's overall much nicer to Elwood in this movie. I mean, she does have like this extending rod thing that she still hits him with.
Yeah.
When he swears or something.
Right.
But other than that, she's rather pleasant.
Yeah. I mean, maybe old age, or maybe just because his brother died.
I don't know.
All right. So the nun tells her that. Curtis, the guy played by Cab Calloway, also passed away.
Right.
He was like a father figure to them. And then the nun also says, oh, you know, Curtis had like a son out of wedlock.
And then she proceeds to give this super convoluted backstory on, here's how he had this kid. And here's why the kid was never mentioned. And here's what...
Like, none of that's important.
Really. None of that is necessary. Just say he has a kid.
Yeah.
The kid is now working as like a state trooper or whatever.
Yeah, his name is Cable Chamberlain, and he's like a commissioner.
Yeah, this is Joe Morton's character.
Yes. So then Elwood's like, oh, well, that guy, since Curtis was like a father to me, then that kid is kind of like my brother.
Right.
So I should go search him out.
And right.
He's my brother.
And by this point, Elwood has decided to reform the band for no particular reason, just to reform the band.
Yeah, I was wondering about that because, like, I mean, I understand why he did it because he doesn't have anything else left to go to. Like, he has no family, no friends, no job, no, you know, wife, no kids.
Right.
So, like, the band and the music is all he has. It would be nice if they kind of went into that a little bit, but they didn't. They just said,
no.
They just said, I want to start the band again.
Yeah, and it's, I mean, the first time. In the first movie, we have a clear motivating factor. They have to raise this money for the orphanage.
Right.
So they're going to do it by getting the band back together and doing some great shows and raising the money that way.
Right.
Here, it's in the reverse. He's like, well, I'll get the band back together. And then it's like, then I have to... And then he wants to get money for a new Bluesmobile. He gets like a new old cop car.
Right.
From
a junkyard headed up by B.B. King, who runs the place.
Right. But he doesn't have the money to pay for the car. So he goes to Joe Morton's character and says, I'm your brother. You've never met me before. Can I have $500?
Solid plan.
And surprisingly, this does not go well.
What?
No.
Huh.
Joe Morton, of course, he looks up Elwood's rap sheet, and he's like, no, you did all this horrible stuff.
It's like, no, you're a criminal.
And he says, like, your last offense, you caused $24 million worth of damages. Which is kind of a fun in joke because that was the budget of the first Blues Brothers movie.
Oh, 25 million. I didn't even catch that.
That was something I read on the IMDb trivia.
Ooh.
So that was a neat little in joke.
I like it.
So
Joe Morton's character, Cab, you know, throws out Elwood and he said, get out and stay out. And Buster kind of bumps into Cab while Cab is on his way back into the building.
Right. And steals his wallet.
So he gives it to Elwood. Elwood takes the money and
gets the new Bluesmobile.
And then they're off to the races. The movie begins.
This is like the first 15, 20 minutes of the movie.
Right.
And then we go back to the Stripster Club.
I'm so shocked that I didn't even notice that Stripster
Club.
That's
what the sign says.
Right.
And then Elwood discovers that Willie is paying money to the Russian mafia as like protection money. This bothers Elwood, so like when the Russians come by, when Willie's not around, he gets the Russians really drunk, and then he teams up with John Belushi's bartender,
right?
And they strip them and they leave them like tied up with duct tape in an alleyway.
I mean, what's that supposed to do? I don't understand.
I think like, it was supposed to scare the Russians off that they were.
But they're Russians. They don't scare.
I don't know.
It's like some like when that part came on, I was like, what? Like, they know you guys. They know to go back to Willie and be like, what'd you do to our guys? And then you know they're going to, like, shoot up the joint. Like,
yeah.
Why are you messing with, why are you poking this bear?
Again.
This Russian bear.
And I'm sorry I keep comparing this to the first movie. It's maybe not entirely fair, but kind of invite the comparison. So
Yeah.
I mean, in the first movie, like, the various people that the Blues Brothers pissed off, usually it was like, who are those guys? I don't know who those guys are. And then they find out who those guys are later in the movie.
Right,
and they're like, oh, let's go after those guys. Here, they know exactly who those guys are. And for payback for this, he gives, Elwood gives John Goodman's character a chance to sing a number with the band because it's like a musical strip club.
Yeah, of course.
I don't even know if that's a thing.
Don't you know strip clubs have karaoke nights? Talent night at this.
Yeah, so like Elwood's like working as the MC at this strip club, and then he lets John Goodman sing a number, and then he's like surprised. Oh, John Goodman can actually sing! Oh my god!
Yeah, you're in the band,
and he declares John Goodman the new lead singer.
Yeah, and then the Russian mobs come back, of course,
right?
Because they're like, hey, you undressed our guys and tied them up. That ain't cool. And then of course they like shoot up the joint, and they set the place on fire.
Yeah.
And
by the way, like John Goodman's first musical number in this movie, 30 minutes into the movie.
Right.
It's not the very first musical number of the movie, but it's like the first time we're really introducing John Goodman's character. And it's.
Right. It's. I mean, he's a fine singer. He's all right. But
I think John Goodman was probably the best possible guy they could have picked to replace the void left by John Belushi. But,
okay, I'll give you that.
I mean, I think John Goodman is an excellent choice. If anybody could have pulled this off, it would have been John Goodman.
Yeah, I just wish they gave him more to do. Like, his character was kind of one note.
Yeah, that really surprised me. I was expecting him to have, like, a similar character or similar function to Jake Blues.
Yeah.
But he's kind of a goody two-shoes type of guy. He's very like an Eager Beaver type. And I was like, oh, gee, golly, I'm in this blues band.
Yeah, exactly. Like, I thought, couldn't they make him a little bit more? I mean, I guess they didn't want to make him too much like Belushi.
I was expecting like more deadpan and stoic in like the Blues Brothers style. And I was expecting more of a dynamic to develop between Goodman and Aykroyd. But no.
They don't really.
It's a very underdeveloped character.
Yeah, like Goodman and Aykroyd, their chemistry is like off.
There's no real back and forth between them. They don't really develop a rapport.
Yeah.
They're just around each other.
Yeah, very much so.
Which is weird.
Yeah. It was,
and I mean, it's also weird because, I mean, we've got this damn kid hanging around. We've got a 10-year-old kid.
Yeah. Like, I feel like it's, It's like in the episode, like the Brady Bunch, when they just added Cousin Oliver.
He
it's
is,
like that.
Yeah, it's like a Cousin Oliver or the Blues Brothers.
Or Different Strokes with the, same, like, you know, when in doubt, just throw a kid in there. And,
yeah, and the kid's name is, the actor's name is J. Evan Bonifant.
Yeah, I don't think he's done much after this.
I haven't looked him up. He apparently does have a Wikipedia entry, so let's see.
All right.
Let's see.
But the Russians set the place on fire, but the Blues Brothers and everybody else escapes. I think the Russians go after them. They escape the Russians, and there's like some type of big car smash. Smash them up accident.
I've got some of J. Evan Bonifant's other credits on his Wikipedia page. He was in Todd Haynes's Dottie Gets Spanked in 1993.
What the?
His most notable role was that of Tum Tum, for which he was nominated the Young Artist Award in 1995 in Three Ninjas Kick Back.
Ooh!
He played 10-year-old Buster Blues in Blues Brothers 2000. In 2008, Bonifant portrayed the role of Jerko Phoenix in the Disney series Wizards of Waverly Place.
Jerko?
So, Jerko.
That sounds erotic.
And he is 33 years old now.
Wow. All right.
33 years old. So he was like he was 12 playing 10.
He was a wee lad.
But there's no reason for his character to be there. I mean, and it's not like this is like this reading about this movie, apparently this role was conceived for Macaulay Culkin.
I mean,
which
all right.
I mean, Macaulay Culkin, he was very big in the early 90s, but
like the late 90s, he was kind of
Late 90s, he was kind of done.
Yeah, it was kind of...
And Macaulay Culkin was 17 years old in 1998. Yeah, I looked it up.
That too.
So he had obviously aged out of this role. I mean, I think they just wanted to... I guess they were looking for kid appeal.
I think they were trying to make this... I mean, I don't think. I know. They were trying to make this more family-friendly.
Yeah.
Like, yeah, blues. Hey, the kids love the blues, right?
But...
Who love the blues more than 10-year-olds?
That's a weird thing to do.
Yes, don't try to make something that's R into something that's PG or PG-13. Let it be R.
Yeah.
All right, but yeah, so the Blues Brothers escaped the Russians, and like, they get into like a big crash accident, and like, you know, say they broke my watch, which was from the first movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so
but
now,
they say it in Russian.
Yes.
So hilarity.
New.
And they like they firebomb the stripster club.
Stripster club. And then of course now the Russian mob are after the Blues Brothers. That's
right.
That's one of the people that's after
and
them.
And then over the course of this they're gradually gathering the band back together.
Yes.
And they go over to Matt Guitar Murphy.
Yes.
Who is still married to Aretha Franklin's character. Yeah. But now, instead of a diner, they're running a used car dealership.
Yeah, a Mercedes dealership.
Okay, yeah, it's probably a new car then.
Yeah.
It's more upscale.
Yeah, they're fancy.
And Aretha does her trademark number, Respect.
She does Respect, and that's fine. That's all right.
And I think she was actually singing it live, because I remember when we were talking about the first movie, like Aretha doesn't typically lip sync, and she wasn't very good at it, because she just tends to just sing live.
Oh, nice.
It seemed like in this, she was singing live.
Okay. Honestly, the best part about this movie was the musical stuff I liked. It's like,
there are some good musical numbers.
I
don't think they had as many good songs or as many standout numbers as the first movie, but...
Yeah, I hear you.
But there's good, solid music.
Yeah. So, like, throughout the movie, they're gathering all the band members. Dunn and Cropper, they're like... radio talk show host, and they
I did kind of like that. I did like that they were like wacky morning DJs.
Exactly. That's right. Mr. Fabulous is like a funeral director, or
that was a little weird.
It was weird. It's like he got into the funeral business, and they were burying somebody, like a Russian family where they were burying, and then they go see Mr. Fabulous.
Yeah.
And then
that seemed like, okay, we got to shoehorn this guy in here somewhere.
I guess so. Yeah. Anyway, at the funeral, like I think it was a Russian funeral. Some of the Russian mob people were there.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, it's the Blues Brothers. And then there's like a shootout at a funeral, but they get away.
Yeah.
That was odd. Then somebody else working at like kind of like a phone sex headquarters where Wilson Pickett was there, and they do a number.
Yeah, they did 867-5309.
No, that's
or five, no, not.
That's.
I went into Jenny. I went into Tommy Toontone. What's the
wrong number?
What's that? It's
863-45789.
It's not as catchy of a phone number.
6-3-4-5-7-8.
It's a good song, though.
It's a good song.
It's a great song. That was one of my favorite numbers from the
movie.
From the movie. Yeah.
That was a good movie. Yeah, yeah, that's a good number. Good number.
Yeah.
Musical and phone.
Yeah.
Their agent, Steve Lawrence, he's back in this. And mm-hmm. So they go to him looking for a gig, and they kind of
And Steve Lawrence books him a gig, and then he also books him like a few road gigs while they're on their way to this Battle of the Bands down in New Orleans.
Right. The big sort of climax is they're on their way to this big Battle of the Bands, like you said, by Queen Musette, played by Erykah Badu. It's like, oh, if you go there, you can make it. So, yeah, they do some gigs along the way. And while they're on the road, I thought this was super shoehorned in the way they did this.
Uh-huh.
Like when they were gassing up, like John Popper from Blues Traveler.
Yeah.
Come, that's like, hey, you're Elwood Blues.
Right.
I grew up with you. I love you, man. You should come check out me and my band. We're about to play in like a few minutes. And like Elwood's like, all right, I'll be there in a bit. And then they just take off. You're like, all right, let's just go.
And then just Blues Traveler plays a number. And then after they're done, it's just John Popper in the parking lot. He's like, hey, where are you?
Yeah.
And I mean, I understand why Blues Traveler wanted to be in it, because they started as a Blues Brothers tribute band, or at least John Popper.
Oh, they did?
Yeah, yeah.
Huh, I didn't know that.
John Popper played Jake in like a Blues Brothers tribute.
Who was Elwood?
Oh, they actually formed in Princeton, New Jersey. All right. New Jersey represent.
Hey, Jersey connection.
Another Jersey connection. Oh. Yay. Let's see.
I didn't know that.
They were a high school garage band formed in Princeton, New Jersey in the mid-1980s. Da, 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 da. I know John Popper played Jake Blues in like a...
Okay, I'll take your word for it. You don't... All right, but yeah, so anyway, so they're on the road. And of course, Joe Morton's character, the commissioner, sees that, like, he gets his wallet back because Elwood mails back his wallet saying, hey, brother, you know, hope it's cool. I took your money to buy a car.
Right.
If you still want to be in the band, you know,
So now Joe Morton and his deputy, Nita Peebles, and her party machine, they are following after the Blues Brothers.
Yeah, apparently they can cross state lines like that and just go into other... Their jurisdiction just runs...
Various state police forces, they just join forces with the FBI, and they follow you wherever you go in the country.
Don't think too much about it and just enjoy the ride.
I mean, I'm not expecting like hardcore realism from a Blues Brothers movie.
Yeah,
but,
I'm not. But that even that, I was like, oh, they can just leave like that.
Yeah, yeah.
And drive to Louisiana
because like the first movie was mostly confined to the Chicago area.
Yeah, yeah. It was all Illinois.
But, yeah. And at one point they go back to the Bob's Country Tavern or Country whatever the name of the.
Bob's Country Kitchen.
Thank you.
But like before, I think it was something else. It was Bob's something else.
Right.
But like,
and by the way, obviously not the same location because it looks nothing like the bar restaurant from the because this movie was shot in Toronto.
What? The whole thing?
The whole thing was shot in Toronto, and they had second unit location footage from Chicago. So anytime you see like Chicago landmarks or anything like that, that's the second unit. You never see like any of the actors in Chicago.
Wow. I did not know that.
Because when I think of the Blues, I think Toronto.
That's right. Sweet home, Toronto.
Apparently the budget on this movie was very tight, and both John Goodman and Dan Aykroyd were paid in scale just to keep the budget down.
Wow.
Which, you know, the scale, if you don't know, that's like the lowest possible.
The minimum.
The Screen Actors Guild minimum that you can be paid.
I thought, and John Landis was,
Yeah.
Same thing. Well, that was... So, I mean, I don't know if I'd take scale just so I can have this made.
Well, that's just me. I guess they really believed in the project or something.
I guess. But, the Blues Brothers and the Banders get us something to eat at Bob's Kitchen. And, of course, the same guy from Bob's Bar is there.
His wife is strangely not present.
Yeah, I mean,
no idea what happened to her. Did they get divorced? Did she die too?
I don't know.
I mean, half the people from the original movie seem to be dead. Maybe she's dead too.
Yeah.
Why didn't we have a subplot about that?
Why isn't her name up there with Candy and Cab Calloway?
Why didn't we tell a whole convoluted story about how they had a kid and she had an affair and then this and that and
So anyway, Bob is there. It's like, hey. Yeah. You guys look kind of familiar.
Yeah, and then all the band like
covers their face.
They're like, check, please.
Yeah,
that was cute. There was a bit like around this part in the movie where they pull up in the Bluesmobile and they open the trunk and Buster the kid who's now dressed as like a mini Blues Brother.
Yeah,
he's like sleeping in the trunk and he's got like a little tiny dresser and he's got a little bed and I thought that was a funny.
That was a funny little side guy. It's like, oh, his home is the trunk of a car.
Yeah, and that's I wish you could have kept this character in the trunk of the car for the entire movie. But
yeah. Oh, and also we should probably mention, I think it's around this point that was it? The Penguin notices, but she sees, oh wait, Buster's not back, and it's been like a week.
Because Elwood was supposed to have him for like 2 hours.
Yeah.
And
he just takes off with the kid.
And so then the nuns call the police, and then the police are...
And then the police go after. It's like, yeah. All right, now we got a missing kid, now we can go after them. Maybe that's why they can cross the line.
We've covered about maybe the first 40 minutes of the movie.
Yeah.
Now, this is like, if you've ever wanted to see the Blues Brothers, but you wish everything took forever to happen, this is the movie for you.
There you go. Yeah, you're welcome, America. So then after that, they kind of escape... They do this one thing where Mighty Mac and Elwood and Buster are in the bathroom, but they see the cops are outside.
Yeah.
So they got to figure out how to escape the cops and leave the diner.
Right.
With the cops right in the diner.
Right.
And so Elwood had this idea to cover his entire head in shaving cream.
Right.
And like kind of pretend he's like a rabid man.
Right.
Like,
I know this sounds like we're just making this up off the top of our heads, but I swear to God, this happened in the movie.
Yeah, and like John Goodman was like, they were all playing. I was like, oh my God, run for your life! He's a rabid man. He's foaming at the head and the mouth.
Yeah,
and he's just like this big, kind of like styrofoamy, like you know, shaving cream head is on him, and like it's like, and of course he's wearing sunglasses, mm-hmm. and he kind of stumbles and scares people, and they get into the car and drive off.
Yep,
and. I mean, what?
Not particularly funny.
No, not at all funny. I was just like...
It's just a thing that happens.
I was just like, oh, they...
It's...
I was like, this made the movie?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm no screenwriter. I'm no screenplay, but like, even if I wrote that as like a first draft, I'd be like, oh no, I can do better than this.
Yeah, yeah.
But so anyway, the Blues Brothers are on the run from the cops and the Russian mob who are on their tail. And there's this thing where the cops are sort of blocking a bridge. So
yeah.
The Blues Brothers get an idea. It's like, all right, roll up the windows. And they drive underwater.
They go underwater, yes.
In order to escape the cops.
Right.
As you do. And, of course, when they come back out of the water, they kind of find their way into this white nationalist rally headed up by Daryl Hammond.
Yes, SNL's Daryl Hammond.
Yeah, yeah, and
Then they like kill him off 2 minutes later.
Yeah, because like of course the white nationalists, of course they have a bomb because they're like you know power to the white man and la la la.
Sure.
And on the way out of the water, the Blues Brothers, they come up
under the boat that has all their bombs and explosives in it.
Right, and so the boat kind of. Flies up in the air or something?
It flew up in the air and then it came down in flaming wreckage on top of Daryl Hammond's character.
Yes, exactly. I know.
And then Daryl Hammond shows up again at the end of the movie, no explanation.
Yeah, without a scratch on him.
No.
That was...
No. And you know, again, I mean, the Blues Brothers, I mean, it's kind of a cartoon world to begin with.
It is.
They really stretched it in this movie. I mean, especially, like, towards the end, when they get down to New Orleans... Okay. There are a few more stops on the way to the Battle of the Bands.
Yeah, we got to do the Monster Truck Rally.
Oh, God. They did a Monster Truck Rally, and then they had the tent revival.
Oh, yeah, thing. The tent revival. Oh, let's do it. All right. So on their way to Louisiana, they stop, and they have a Monster Truck Rally concert in Kentucky.
Right.
And they got that through Steve Lawrence, their agent.
Right.
Because Steve Lawrence said, oh, yeah, because like the venue wants, you know, country music. They want
so they're the Bluesgrass Brothers.
Yeah. It's like, oh, yeah, yeah, they're the Bluesgrass Brothers. And, of course, the band doesn't know until they get there.
Yeah, just like when they were in Bob's Country Kitchen in the first movie. Only not as funny.
Exactly. So they end up, it's like, oh, yeah, we do bluegrass. Sure. Yeah, that's the ticket. So they end up doing, they sing Ghost Riders in the Sky, which is like an old...
Right, and while they're doing it, you see clouds rolling in above, because it's an outdoor venue, it's a Monster Truck Rally, and then they have like these CGI skeletons riding horses.
The Ghost Rider, them singing about Ghost Riders in the Sky causes a huge like thunderstorm and rainstorm to happen, and like ghosts... riding in the sky on horses come out of the dark clouds and you know Ghost Riders in the Sky.
That's the point where the movie like starts getting really, really trippy.
It got really weird, but the audience is really into it. They're like, yeah, and they're like, you know, they like rush the stage and people are loving it, and they're just like,
and the cops are closing in.
Cops are closing in, you know, it's very odd, but like, and of course they see the cops, and it's the minute that they're done with the song, they get into the car and and take off as, as quickly as possible.
Yeah.
And it was an odd scene.
Very odd. Very odd scene. Yeah. And then next we had...
Then the tent revival. Because the car runs out of gas.
They run out of gas. They send... what's his name?
Dunn or...
Lou Marini. Blue Lou Marini.
Blue Lou.
And they do make a point of like giving everybody in the Blues Brothers band at least a couple lines of dialogue.
Yeah, yeah.
In the movie, which is nice.
Yeah.
And then the rest of them, they go to the tent revival.
Right.
And then we work in James Brown's character.
Yeah, it's the same character
in the first movie.
Reverend Cleophas.
Yes, from Chicago.
From Chicago. And they have like a big tent revival, and they check out the... They want to go see Cleophas because I think they want to try to get some gas money from him.
Right.
Because they're like, oh yeah, Cleophas, he knows me, I can get some gas money from him. Oh.
But Blue Lou gets the gas on his own
somehow they
never explain. He just shows up in the Bluesmobile at
the end. He just has some money on him, I guess.
And Joe Morton closes in again.
Yes, the cops close in.
And then he has a revelation during the tent revival.
Yes,
embraces his true heritage.
Yeah, there's a scene basically when they're just about to arrest him, the chorus and the choir begin to sing, and of course James Brown starts to preach, and it's like, do you see the light? Do you see the light? And then Joe Morton sees a light, and he literally like levitates up out of the tent.
Into the sky.
Into the heavens.
Like well over the tent, and like, you know, not especially great CGI. And he's got like sparks traveling all around him.
Right. And he realizes his true calling is to be a Blues Brother.
And he magically transforms from his uniform into the Blues Brothers outfit.
Right. And he comes back down through the tent, and he's like, now I'm part of the band now.
Right.
And like he dances with the band. And of
course, right.
And of course, the Blues Brothers escape with Joe Morton now.
If you are keeping count, we now have four Blues Brothers.
Right.
Four.
Four Blues
Brothers. We've gotten three characters to replace one.
And it's still not...
No, and there's still a void. There's still
a void!
Why didn't they just pick one character and go with that?
I don't know!
Or maybe two. You don't need the kid. And Joe Morton's character, he changes so late in the movie. It's like, well, what the hell was the point of that?
But
and
he didn't know his purpose till he saw the light.
Neither did this screenplay.
wow. Damn, son. Shots fired.
And somewhere in there they had the big car wreck. This was before.
Yeah.
And this, by the way, they wrecked 104 cars to break the record from the previous movie of the 103 cars.
Right? That'll make this movie better.
But it happens in the middle of the movie, and it doesn't have the same sort of comedic impact.
Yeah, it's literally like 2 minutes of a bunch of cars crashing into each other. Because like I think they're, you know, once the cops try to chase the Blues Brothers, I think they go down like some, you know, dead end road or something like that, but then the car stops, so then the car behind that car crashes into him.
Don't try to figure out the logic of the car crashes.
That car crashes into him, and then the car that flies over all of them and crashes into the first car.
Yeah.
And it's just cars crashing into each other
for
2 minutes.
Yeah. You timed it.
Yeah. I didn't time it, but I guesstimated it. It's just literally like a bunch of Hot Wheels just smashing into each other.
Yeah.
And it's just oof. So that's that part. And so then they go to Louisiana to see Erykah Badu, Queen Musette. Paul Schaefer's there.
Paul Schaefer.
He's like Queen Musette's servant, I guess.
Interesting backstory of Paul Schaefer. Paul Schaefer was the original keyboardist for the Blues Brothers band, helped, you know, put together the Blues Brothers band. But when the time came to make the first movie, Paul Schaefer had a conflict. He was not able to do it because he was contracted to... Gilda Radner's show on Broadway.
Oh, that's where Belushi was like kind of in his face about it a little bit, right?
I didn't hear about that.
Oh, but, I thought it was. All right, maybe I made that up.
That seems surprising because Belushi just seems like such an even-tempered guy.
Yeah, he's cool, calm, and collected all the time.
Yeah, he probably took that very well.
Yeah. Rest in peace.
But so he was finally able to be in the Blues Brothers movie because this was like a big regret of Paul Schaefer's. You know, why wouldn't it be?
Yeah, of course.
By this point, Schaefer had been the band leader on the Letterman show for years and years and years.
Right.
Took a week off from the Letterman show to do this. And Warren Zevon took his place that week on the show.
Oh,
that's cool.
The Z.
Warren Zevon, enjoy every sandwich.
Mm-hmm.
And it says here on Wikipedia, Schaefer shaved his head for the role, a change in appearance he chose to retain permanently.
I see.
So if like Paul Schaefer was a comic book character in his like Marvel Universe handbook entry, it would say like first appearance bald head, and it would give Blues Brothers 2000 as.
So we have Blues Brothers 2000.
That is the demarcation of Paul Schaefer and his totally shaved head.
Oh, I don't know what to I don't know what to think about that. Wow, that's oh boy.
So yeah, take that little bit of trivia.
take that with you. All right, so they go play for Queen Musette. She wants them to play like some Caribbean music, and of course they say they don't do that. But she then cast because Queen Musette, she's like this voodoo, dark arts type of black magic lady,
right? Who's supposedly like immortal or at least very old, and she's they say she might be a cannibal, and
there's like a lot of lore behind her.
Yeah, yeah.
So anyway, they say we don't do Caribbean music, but then she casts a spell on them. And they do Funky Nassau, which is one of my favorite songs.
She turns them into zombies.
Yeah, all right. If you want to go that route.
They all have green skin, and they're dancing around like the Frankenstein monster, stiff-armed. And it's like, why is this happening? Why? What the?
Yeah, is this really a contest now that you put a spell on them?
And it's just very weird. Like I said, I mean, Blues Brothers, it's always been sort of over-the-top and cartoony, but this like went to the point of surreal.
Very much so. It's very odd. It's like,
turns them into zombies.
I mean, the Ghost Riders in the Sky was surreal too. This was even more surrealer.
And like before the Ghost Riders in the Sky thing, there was another gag where they're sneaking in the Bluesmobile. They painted the Bluesmobile blue.
Oh, right.
And you see Mighty Mac, John Goodman's character, driving the Bluesmobile with Buster the Kid next to him. And then he's like, oh, Elwood, I don't know. And then he opens up the ashtray, and you see Elwood's chin in the ashtray.
Oh.
And he's like, oh, don't worry, this is all going to... No.
So is he hiding in the engine? or the dashboard?
He apparently got himself into the ashtray.
I didn't even notice that. Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
Now, it's a very quick gag, but it was like, what the, huh?
he's hiding in the glove box.
Yeah. No, not even the glove box. Ashtray.
Maybe his torso's in the glove box, but his head's in the ashtray.
No, he's literally just in the ashtray, I think.
I guess it's like one of those things. It's like, oh, it's a magic car. Just
But it's weird.
Yeah. All right. So then they zombify perform through Funky Nassau, which is one of my favorite songs from the '70s, and then
they become statues at the end of it.
Yeah,
they become immobile statues.
Yes. So then the queen likes their performance that she, forced them to do under her spell.
Right.
And then they get into the battle of the band.
I like that thing I just commanded you to do.
you go on to the next round, kid. So then they have to perform against this other band in order to win. And the other band is this band called the Louisiana Gator Boys, comprised of a few notable musicians you might have heard of.
A few.
Including B.B. King and Lou Rawls and Isaac Hayes and Eric Clapton and Dr. John and Steve Winwood and Clarence Clemens and Bo Diddley and Billy Preston and Charlie Musselwhite and Jimmy Vaughn and Coco Taylor and Travis Tritt and Grover Washington Jr. and Joshua Redman. And that's just a few of them.
Yeah.
So it's this uber mega group, basically.
Right.
This super group of people they're playing. And this is probably... I like this performance a lot. I thought it was the best part of the movie.
This was the big climax of the movie. It's like the battle of the bands. So we hear the Louisiana Gator Boys play a number, then the Blues Brothers play a number, and then the Blues Brothers lose the battle of the bands.
What? Spoiler.
And then after that, it's just hey, do you guys want to jam together? And then they have a big jam session together.
And either before or after the jam, that's when the Russian mob finds them and comes in.
Right.
And they're like, yeah, there they are. And they're about to shoot them up. Oh, and also the white nationalists with Daryl Hammond, they come in at the same time.
Right.
And
inexplicably alive again.
Yeah. And they're like, there they are. Right. And of course, the queen, Erykah Badu, just turns them both into rats. And
that's
the end of that plot line.
Yeah. And she transforms like Elwood and Mighty Mac and Joe Morton's cab character back.
Oh yeah, from she turns
statues
she
right before the number.
She unstatuifies them before they're supposed to perform. Which and they perform. They lose, of course, to B.B. King, and lose. Of course, you're gonna lose to B.B. King.
Yeah,
and Eric Clapton and this fucking murderer's row of musicians.
Right, right.
And so then they just end up jamming with everybody. It's a big old jam fest at the end. That sounded gross.
And the penguin shows up at the end,
too. Oh, yeah,
too.
The penguin shows up, and the cops find them.
Yeah, and they make a getaway because, he's kidnapped the child.
Yeah, you can't do that, I guess.
Apparently not.
Yeah, so of course, they say, oh, we're a family now. We're brothers. Right. We'll make a escape. You guys keep playing. So, they all hug and say Blues Brothers for life or whatever. And Elwood and Buster make an escape out the back way. And Cab and Mighty Mac perform. And they keep performing while, Elwood and Buster make their escape. One of the cops, of course, see them. Be like, hey, follow that car. And, of course, they're just driving on the road with an army of cops chasing after them. And then that's the end of the movie. It's just,
Yep.
They're just constantly on the run.
Yeah.
Just the good old boys, never meaning no harm.
Been in trouble with the law since the day they were born.
They probably were.
They probably were.
Yeah, that's it. That's the movie. It kind of ends on a...
It is not a good movie. Honestly, it wasn't the total train wreck I was expecting. It got worse as it went on.
Yeah.
But... the first half, I was like, oh, okay, well, this is all right. It's kind of slow. It's kind of meandering, but it's not.
But then it just keeps
horrible.
It just keeps being slow and meandering.
Yeah, yeah. It never really builds up the momentum. I mean, the first movie built beautifully, and it got more and more absurd as it went on.
Right.
And this no, not so much.
Yeah, I mean, well, I touched on it at the beginning. What I realized about the first one that's different from this one is. The first one, even though it's a dedication to the blues and R&B, it also has a very strong punk rock type of, frantic, anarchistic vibe about it. Like, driving through a mall and, what they did with the good old boys and, plowing through Illinois Nazis.
You have Carrie Fisher following him with a bazooka.
Yeah, and a bazooka and a gun and all this shoot 'em up stuff, all this crazy off-the-wall stuff. Mm-hmm. And none of that is in this movie. It's like a very kind of neutered...
It's a very pedestrian kind of Blues Brothers movie.
Exactly. Like, instead of going gonzo with it, they just kind of went, well, let's appeal to the kids now.
Yeah, it's a much mellower Blues Brothers movie.
I mean, I understand that because, everybody's older now. They don't move like they used to.
Yeah, that's true.
Aykroyd can't dance like he used to.
Although, Aykroyd, he did get himself in shape... to do this movie. It says here on the IMDb trivia page, he reportedly lost 90 pounds to reprise the role of Elwood Blues. Way to fucking go, Dan Aykroyd. 90 pounds.
Nice,
that's awesome.
Man. Good for you, bro.
Here's another interesting bit of trivia. Both Dan Aykroyd and John Landis hated the script and felt that the movie was going to be a failure.
Oof. Wait, didn't they write the script?
They wrote the script.
Yeah, that's...
If you hated the script, that was in your power to change, guys.
That's what it took me, man. I think I said at the beginning they wrote this, didn't they?
I don't understand that.
I mean, do they hate it because maybe the suits made them change it?
Maybe. Apparently, there was some studio interference with this movie, and I'm sure the studio was pushing them to do the PG-13.
Yeah.
It says here, their original story pitch for the film had Elwood, Mighty Mac, and Jim Belushi's character Brother Z raising money to refurbish their old orphanage. Aykroyd later admitted that the studio had been right to reject this pitch, as it was virtually identical to the story of the original Blues Brothers, but felt that their decision to instead make the film more fantasy-based and aimed at younger viewers ensured that the final product would be a critical and commercial failure.
Yeah,
which it was.
It's not... Blues Brothers isn't for kids. Kids aren't... Gonna be no. Like, oh yeah, Blues Brothers, all right.
Yeah.
Kids are into Ninja Turtles and, fucking blow-em-up stuff.
Yes.
And what have you.
Ninja Turtles and fucking blow-em-ups.
Yes. They're into the blow-em-ups and what have
you.
They like the Power Rangers and the la-di-da.
By the way, there was also a Blues Brothers 2000 video game.
Yes, I remember that. For the NS...
Nintendo 64.
Nintendo 64, yeah.
Released on November 17th, 2000. Which, by the way, more than 2 years after the film's release.
Their timing throughout this whole thing.
At least it came out in the year 2000, though.
In the year 2000.
But I mean, at that point,
like, what's the,
what is the point of releasing a tie-in video game than 2.5 years?
I don't know. I don't know. Look, we don't work in the industry. We don't claim to, but... Are you all right, man? You're losing it.
If you're doing a tie-in to a product, it should maybe come out somewhat close to that product.
Maybe it came out in time for the DVD release of it?
I don't know.
I don't know. I like the DVD of this movie you didn't see? Well, maybe buy the video game. Huh?
I don't.
We're trying to recoup here, guys. But yeah, I kind of feel like, because they knew that there would be a huge void without them having Belushi, they kind of maybe doubled up on, like, musical performances.
They're yes.
Like, oh, we don't have...
I think there are, like, 14 musical numbers in this movie.
There's a lot of musical... So I guess they figure, we don't have the same zany comedy, but we're going to have twice the music.
Yeah.
So it's going to be all about the blues. And it's like, it shows, because the best part about this movie is the musical
performance. I mean, yeah, honestly, they should have just done, like, a concert film.
Yeah.
You know, like the Blues Brothers Live.
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, I mean, that would have been fun. That could have been fun, and that could have been something different, and you might not have felt the absence of John Belushi quite as much.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been great.
This movie was not critically well received. In 2008, it was rated number 4 in Entertainment Weekly's top 25 worst sequels ever made.
Ooh. Number 4, that's pretty high.
Yeah, that is pretty high.
Wow.
We have some critic reviews here on Rotten Tomatoes. Mm-hmm. Mike Clark from USA Today says, "Now a sequel has arrived, Blues Brothers 2000, offering more of the same and less." And Joe Layton from Variety says, "The sequel offers more of the same, only less."
Yes. So if you want the same thing but less of it,
yes,
check out Blues Brothers 2000.
Time Out said, "This isn't a sequel, it's a remake." Let's see. Mick LaSalle from the San Francisco Chronicle said, "It makes an audience pay for every 2 seconds of pleasure with 10 seconds of pain."
Wow. Okay. Yeah, there's a lot. Yeah. Well, I mean, we put out the word on Twitter that we were doing this, and we asked with the SNL nerdaholics out there what they were had to say about it.
Is that what we're calling them now?
Sure.
Okay.
And, you know, until we change it. Yes. So there's this one person, at Puppet Reviews 15 said, Blues Brothers 2000, successful ruined the original. Since the orphanage closed anyway, what was the point of paying the property taxes in the first film?
Yep.
And of course, and if they go on to say, convincing myself Blues Brothers 2000 doesn't exist, help me sleep at night. that's a good way to be.
Yes.
Oh, and we also got, like, a message from one of our loyal listeners.
Mm-hmm.
At Cool Ranch for Life. Because, like, I think I mentioned a while ago that we were going to do this, and then Cool Ranch said that they had a good idea for a sequel.
Oh, okay. Let's hear it.
Okay, so Jake and Elwood run a music school. Jake then mysteriously dies suddenly, and Elwood looks into it, finding that his family has a curse, and the only way to break it is to go down to the south and defeat an eldritch creature. He teams up with Erica Badu, who is a teacher at the school. Down south, they meet extended relatives and Dr. John, who may not be what he seems. I mean, that's pretty interesting.
That sounds more intriguing.
Yeah.
I mean, it sounds a little Scooby-Doo-ish, but...
we got ourselves a groovy mystery to solve, gang.
This comment really amused me. I just have to read this. This is from Christopher Weathers on Twitter, who is responding to our tweet. He said, "Some little kid, I want to say his name is Scribbles." And and he CC'd How Did This Get Made on it. Because How Did This Get Made, about a year ago, they did a wonderful episode about this movie.
Oh, did they?
Yeah, Blues Brothers 2000. Very funny. If you don't listen to How Did This Get Made, great, great podcast. They don't really need our help to plug because they are huge.
Let's help that little startup.
Yeah, that's, you know, Paul Scheer, June Diane Raphael, and
Jason Mantzoukas.
Jason Mantzoukas, hilarious. Mm. Love that podcast. Great, great stuff. But yeah, they decided to call the character Buster Scribbles. So that amused me.
Oh, okay, that's where I didn't get that reference. I thought it was like a DJ Scribbles or something. I don't know.
Nope.
I didn't get it.
Nope.
Yeah. All right. Well,
she was, June could not remember the name of Buster's character, so she just called him Scribbles. And they called him Scribbles throughout the rest of the episode. I'm going to re-listen to that one because I remember it being very funny.
All right, I'm going to listen to it. I'm going to listen to it right after this.
So yeah.
All right. So yeah. So that's the movie. It's a big old disappointment. It's a movie. It's not great, but at least it's 2 hours long.
I think it's
2 and change, 2 hours,
4 minutes long. So yeah,
they could have chopped that down way.
Yeah.
I mean, the original was like 2 hours, but it didn't feel like it.
No,
this feels like it.
This feels like it. Yeah.
Every time I was checking the time, like, so how much longer we got here?
Oh, you were doing like I was
a little
with,
bit.
With
I
its
was
Pat,
like, yeah.
checking the time every 10 minutes.
I was like, so how much we? Oh how much, God.
Okay. Yeah. All right, we're going to get through this.
An hour 55. You kidding me?
I would say it was okay at best. I would say I certainly liked it better than It's Pat or Stuart Saves His Family.
All right.
I would say it entertained me more. I mean, for the musical numbers, if nothing else.
Yeah. I mean, definitely better than It's Pat.
Stuart, yeah. I mean most things are better than It's Pat. And I would put it above Coneheads.
Ooh, wow.
I think, yeah. Yeah, I would put it above Coneheads.
Okay, that's fair enough.
Should we rank these when we get to the end?
Oh, that'd be interesting. Summer?
Should we develop a ranking?
That's interesting. Maybe. Mm. Will we do it, fellow listeners? Stay tuned.
Mm. All right. So that's Blues Brothers 2000. If you haven't seen it, you're not really missing much of anything. But you know, maybe get the soundtrack.
Yeah, get the soundtrack and
see if iTunes has the soundtrack.
I'm sure it does. Or just like go to your local Goodwill and look through the bins.
There you go. Buy a used CD. You know, support your local music stores.
Darn tootin'. Yeah.
That's right.
Go to, what you calls it? The Tower Records, sir.
I don't think Tower Records exists anymore.
Go to your local Sam Goody. And
go to that music shop that Ray Charles ran in the first one. And,
there you go.
After you attempt to steal the guitar off the wall
and
Ray Charles shoots at you, see if he has a CD
of
Blues Brothers 2000.
Exactly.
So
tell me what I say. All right, so yeah, and that's our podcast today. So how do you want to wrap this baby up? Do you got anything to promote?
Well, we've got a little something to promote. We got some exciting news.
Oh, do we?
We do. We have booked a gig. We have a gig coming up.
We do. July 25th. We're gonna be at characters in Sloatsburg, New York.
Mm-hmm.
They're doing like a big old comedy
tournament.
Tournament.
Yes. Comedy competition.
Comedy competition.
It's a thing they do every year.
Yeah. I will be hosting, and Mr. Trumbull here will be comedying.
Yes. I will be closing out the show. Yes.
Spitting hot fire.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right. So if you ever wanted to come see us live and see us do our acts, our comedian acts, or do our little stand-up mix-em-ups.
Yes. If you want to see us talk about something other than Saturday Night Live,
right.
Come on to this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We will talk about a couple of other subjects.
Yes. Just a few.
Just two.
We don't know much.
No.
Outside.
We're very sheltered.
Yes. Exactly.
But just come on out to characters. It's fun. You'll see a ton of really funny comedians.
Yeah.
If you see us and if you listen to the show, come say hi.
Yeah, we're approachable people. Just get by our security guard and we'll say
that's
hey.
That's right. That's right. Yeah,
just don't touch us.
That's
We'll be happy to sign something for you for a small fee.
Yes.
Photographs. You know, that's 50 autographs. We'll give it to you for 45.
And that is happening again Thursday, July 25th.
Yes.
At Characters Bar and Restaurant in Sloatsburg, New York.
Sloatsburg.
So, yeah, come check it out.
If you want to follow me on Twitter and Instagram, I'm at DarinCredible, DarinCredible.
And you can follow me on Twitter at Trumbull Comic. And let me just check. Let me see if we've had any more wonderful audience reviews.
Ooh, yes.
On
and while John checks our reviews, you can always, of course, donate to our Patreon, non-productive.com. We have a Patreon page if you want to donate some dough. And of course, you can always listen to us on Stitcher, iTunes, Google Play, Spotify too.
Yeah.
And non-productive.com.
All that. Please rate us and review us on wherever you listen to the podcast. And speaking of ratings and reviews, we do have a new rating and review. We got a 5-star rating from DM Piccolo.
Hey-o!
And the headline is, "Better than the show itself!"
Yes!
Exclamation point.
We did it!
DM Piccolo says, "I am not a huge SNL fan, but boy..."
What?
But boy, do I enjoy Darren and John talking about it. Very in-depth, interesting observations, plus it's super fun. Get into it!
Oh!
Get into it!
Ah!
So be like DM Piccolo, people.
Yeah, I mean, he
seems cool.
Thanks,
he seems Piccolo. Nice.
Yeah, I mean, you're not a big SNL fan, which you need to change about your life, but thank you so much for the
But
review.
As long as you still derive entertainment from our show, yes. We're not going to be picky about it.
As long as you give us praise, we're okay with you not being
That's
a
right.
huge SNL fan.
We are very emotionally fragile.
Yes. We're delicate like a cheap plate.
We are not paid like the SNL cast members
no.
and writers and directors are.
Not even like the custodians.
So we just subside on the yes. praise of others.
We feed and feast off of praise.
Yes.
Yes.
So that is
we
what we
suckle
do.
On the teat. Oh,
and next week, we've got a few more SNL movies
yeah,
to cover.
We're coming to the end of this SNL movie
Flying
thing.
Flying through them.
We've done,
let's see, this was our seventh.
Lucky number seven.
Next week, mm-hmm. it is A Night at the Roxbury, which
What is Love?
Yes, the movie with the Roxbury guys, the Butabi brothers.
Yes.
The two guys who are always bobbing their heads.
Yeah.
And, yeah me, you, you, me, me.
Remember that
you,
was a
you,
thing?
Me,
yeah, yeah.
Me,
okay.
Yeah. And it's implied they do cocaine.
Yes.
So we're going to see if that can be extended out into an hour and a half, 2 hour movie. I have no idea how long this movie is. I've never seen this movie. It's Will Ferrell. It's Chris Kattan. It's
Molly Shannon's in it.
Okay.
Amy
Heckerling directed it, right?
No. It was directed by John Fortenberry.
Amy Heckerling was a producer on it.
Yes.
Okay.
But yeah, John Fortenberry, he directed Jury Duty, the Pauly Shore movie, which edged out Stewart Saves His Family only years ago.
Well, that's quite a pedigree. I'm quite looking forward to this now.
So hot damn, yeah. Clear your weekend.
That's right.
You got plans, buddy boy.
So we're gonna check this out. You have you seen it before?
I saw it for my college newspaper. Yeah.
But when it came out
90, I saw it back.
Are you gonna be able to dig up your old college newspaper review?
I wish I could. Maybe. I gotta find it.
Go into the archives.
Yeah, maybe. I'll see what I can... If I can find my old college review, I will...
I want to hear what college-age Darren Patterson thought of this movie.
Oh, I had thoughts.
Yes.
I had a lot of thoughts.
All right. Well, we're going to have further thoughts on it, so please tune in next week. Podcast drops every Monday, and so check us out.
Check it out.
All right. Till then, bye.
Later.
This has been a Non-Productive Media presentation. Executive producer, Frank Hablawi. This program and many others like it on the Non-Productive Network is distributed under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial No Derivatives license. Please share it, but ask before trying to change it or sell it. For more information, visit non-productive.com.